Blogging the Boys presents Cowboys Radio with Rabs and McCool. Here are your hosts, Rabble Rouser and Landon McCool.
Hello, howdy, and welcome to another edition of Blogging the Boys Cowboys Radio. I'm Landon McCool, and with me as always, except this time on the West Coast, here in Oxnard, is Rabble Rouser. Rabble, how's the West Coast weather treating you?
I have to say the West Coast is and its weather are being very, very friendly. I'm doing awesome. You know, last time we talked, I told you how juiced I get about going to training camp. Here I am. I'm in training camp. I was there the last 4 days. Oxnard is beautiful. The sea breeze is coming up and, you know, cooling my hot, tired face. And I'm hanging with the brightest stars in the Cowboys blogosphere. I got OCC, got my boy Rafael Vila, Dan Turner's come in from London area, and of course, there's the great Landon McCool, who I hung out with last Saturday. So what's not to love, man?
Well, there certainly is a lot to love about what's going on with Cowboys camp. I mean, we got to witness the first padded practice on Saturday, which was great, and then they had their second one on Sunday. So we got a little bit of information to talk about. So let's go ahead and get right into that, and we'll go ahead and I'll ask some questions. You've been there for all four practices. I was there for one day, so I'm going to be asking you most of the questions, and I'll be all of your guides to the information inside of Rabble's head, which we will promptly split open and gather all the information. But before we do, I want to go ahead and plug Blogging the Boys. It is your one-stop shop for all this Cowboy information. That's where Rabble's going to put all his practice updates. OCC will put his as well, and Michael Sizemore has been doing his training camp updates there as well. But also into the preseason, season, postseason, Blogging the Boys is the place to go to. Make sure you check out their Facebook page as well, Blogging the Boys, and their Twitter handle at Blogging the Boys. So let's get right into it. What have you what's your just general impression so far in the first 4 days? Like we said, we've seen two padded practices and then two kind of general walkthrough technique oriented sort of practices. So what's been your general impression overall so far?
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about this yesterday, and I've been thinking about it a little bit more today, today being Monday, the first off day. And I have to tell you, camp has been a little slow, frankly, but I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. And I'll tell you why I think it's slow. You know, if we jump back a year ago, one of the burning questions, or many burning questions, but one of the ones that was occupying the forefront of our imaginations most actively was, you know, how is Tony Romo going to be? The news, the constant daily updates about his back created a kind of energy and propulsion about that camp. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, you know, is Zach Martin going to play, you know, guard? And what's that going to do to the offensive line? How are they going to come together? And what's going on with the defense? And how are they going to survive without Jason Hatcher and DeMarcus Ware? There seemed to be all these kind of questions about the roster that had to be resolved. How are they going to survive without Sean Lee? There are all these kind of burning questions that I think produce a kind of anxiety that propels and fuels the conversation about training camp. So the fact that this training camp is a little slow is not necessarily a bad thing. I think what it means is that, frankly, there are fewer burning questions. We're not so anxious as a fan base this year. So let me ask you this. Consider, let's imagine that instead of a starting 22 in this age of frequent substitutions, there is, let's just say there's a starting 26.
Yeah, with packages and everything like that.
Precisely. How many of those guys of the starting 26 do you think will be new additions, rookies, etc., in 2015? Now, provided you know, we're not talking about knock on wood, a seasoned veteran going down with an injury. Barring injury, how many new guys will there be in that starting 26?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, you know, just off the top of my head and being very unscientific about it, I would imagine at the most maybe three or four positions. I mean, like, I can't imagine. And even those would be like the most starting quote unquote position would be a potential for Lael Collins to possibly unseat Leary. But I imagine that Randy Gregory will. I mean, I don't know if we would consider that a starter if he's like a third down rush package guy. You know, I think, you know, that Byron Jones maybe is kind of a similar situation where he's, you know, maybe a nickel back, that sort of thing. So, but as far as like, you know, really core 26 guys, I mean, like I said, maybe only two or three or four, and I mean one for sure is just is because of losses, DeMarco Murray, you know, and then
right.
and
right.
then one, but that's only because, but actually now that I say that, that's not necessarily being filled by a rookie or a first year player. I mean, Randall's a third year player, so it's kind of a. That's kind of a tough spot. I mean, I would say as far as rookies, first year player, maybe just one or two, I would think.
Yeah, and one might even add if that.
Yeah.
So,
oh,
so
yeah, no, that's that, and those aren't for certain. You know, yeah, absolutely.
And that's being, you know, deeply speculative about the question.
Absolutely.
So I pose this question, not, you know, to put you on the spot, but to say that I think it's a kind of rhetorical question that we all need to be asking ourselves. So and I think you identified them pretty accurately. So on offense, it's very clear we're going to have a new running back this year. And in many regards, that's the kind of sole sight of our collective angst as Cowboy fans. But if you think about the other starting 10, and then of course we're going to say that that 11th offensive player is probably two or three different people. Mm-hmm. So the 11th offensive player is divided between Cole Beasley,
Escobar,
you know, Klutz, Escobar, yeah. etc.
Mm-hmm.
That those guys aren't changing.
Yeah.
So if you think there's actually probably a starting 13 on offense, only one of those is going to change, and maybe two if you really believe that Leo Collins is going to beat out Leary. But all indications from this point are that he won't, but that he'll be a very, very talented backup this year. And then on defense, if you think about week one, there's a really good chance that week one, across the starting front, we're going to see Tank Lawrence, Nick Hayden, Tyrone Crawford, and Jeremy Mincy, which is exactly the starting group from last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to probably see you know, at least two of the three cornerbacks who get the most heavy play are going to be the two who got the heaviest play last year, with the exception of the return of Mo Claiborne, who, again, is not a rookie. He's a veteran. And the two starting safeties are going to be the same. So other than potentially the running back and maybe a position or two in the linebacking core, we're talking about the same team. And so there's not much roster flux really at any position other than, and this is just what I gestured toward, the linebacker. And so to me, other than this kind of open question about what they're going to do at linebacker, you know, whether it's can Joseph Randall and or Lance Dunbar and or Darren McFadden carry the load? Are they going to get another guy? If so, who's that guy? The other question, and that's not something that can necessarily even be solved at camp. So to me, I almost have to put that question aside and say, I'll deal with that later. I have other things I need to observe now and prioritize. And for me, that leaves only the linebacking core.
Yeah, so, I was going to say the linebackers are really the only spot where it seems like there's been a change, a lot of turnover, and a lot of you know, influx situations, whether it's through injury or through replacement of people that have left. But
that's
yeah.
exactly right. And you know, the interesting thing about that is that also is in some ways a kind of wait and see thing. So
yeah.
it's not the kind of thing where we're able to engage in, you know, hours or endless speculation about who's going to beat out whom, because Sean Lee is on a kind of extended rehab program. They're holding him out of a lot of the competitive periods and the 11-on-11 periods for precautionary reasons, because he's still, you know, getting his sea legs under him, so to speak. Rolando McClain hasn't begun to practice yet. And those are your two most, you know, if you're going to rank your linebackers from 1 to 9, they're going to be 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing a lot of Anthony Hitchens, which is good. We're seeing a lot of Kyle Wilbur, which is good, because those guys are going to, I think, get a lot of snaps. They'd probably be numbers 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a decent amount of Damian Wilson, which is good, because he seems to be Anthony Hitchens 2.0. So these are all good things, you
mm-hmm.
know. But even in terms of how is this actually going to work out, that's a question we can't answer, because we have to see Lee and McClain on the field together before a lot of the other stuff can even sort itself out. And so,
and even the way that question is phrased, you know, like it's different than it was last year. Instead of it being like, oh God, how is this going to work out, it's just more of a, how is this going to work out? I mean, it's not like we don't have solutions in-house to the problem. I mean, I feel confident about the linebacking core. It's just that we just don't know exactly how it's going to all fit together yet. I like all the pieces, I guess, is what I'm saying.
It's absolutely
really about how they get arranged more than anything.
Precisely. And I think, you know, linebacker, are we going to have six? Are we going to carry seven? If so, who are numbers six and seven? I mean, I think those are legitimate questions that will have to be answered once we see what's going on with the top two guys. But you're absolutely right. Last year, it was this kind of like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And this year, it's
What are they going to do? Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, so if you think about this time last year, that was, I don't think Rolando McClain had come in yet. Or if he had, he just.
No.
At this point, last year, he wasn't here. 4 days.
No.
And so we were looking at Justin Durant.
Sorry,
I always messed that up.
Yeah, a lot of people do that.
And Bruce Carter, and thinking, dear God, what are we going to do without Sean Lee?
Yeah.
And that ended up working itself out pretty well. And so we're not having even that level of question or perturbation this year. So that's sort of observation number one. And it's in some ways, it's like this is a good problem to have, right? The problems that good deep teams have is that their fans are not particularly distraught over the fact that there are all these kind of problems at different positions because there just aren't any.
Well, I was just going to say, like, that harkens back to a conversation that you and I had on Saturday where we were talking about the fact that, you know, it's crazy that and this kind of feeds right into what you're saying. It's crazy the talent infusion that this team got in the offseason. And when you consider that, I mean, they had a great offseason where I think talent acquisition was fantastic. Like, I think they really did a great job of acquiring a whole bunch of talent. But keeping that in mind, there still isn't a lot of open spots for competition. I mean, that's how talented this team is that they got all this great talent in the offseason. But, I mean, all of that great talent is still going to be fighting really, really hard to even see the field.
And that's
the sign of not only a deep team, but a talented at the top team, you know, I think, which is really scary. I think last year we kind of proved that maybe we had some talent at some spots and we were deep at some spots. But this year, kind of going into the season, I feel great about not only the talent at the top, but the depth, you know, almost all the way across the board. I mean, with maybe the exception being of running back, just because we don't know what we have in running back yet. So,
right. I think there are two other rhetorical questions we can pose about the roster, right? It's just sort of thought experiment or questions. And the first is, so the draft was lauded for the fact that they got three quote unquote first rounders. It's been a long time since they had a first rounder who didn't, gets inserted into the lineup almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And so here we are in 2015, and the question is, how many of those first rounders are going to start week one?
And the answer, honest to God, I mean, if I was going to put money down right now, I would say zero.
I would too. And then let's extend that. How many of them do you think will be starting week four, provided there are no injuries?
I would still say zero. I think at this point, the best chance may be Byron Jones in, like, if we're going to call some nickel position a starting position. I just don't see Collins taking Leary's spot this season, and I think Gregory's going to see a lot of snaps on passing situations, but I don't think he's going to be our starting right defensive end. I mean, clearly he's not once Hardy gets back.
I think that Jones and Gregory are going to be very valuable pieces to a suddenly young and talented and deep defense, but I don't necessarily know that they'll be starting at any point this year, you know, provided that there's health above them. So that's rhetorical question number one. And the second then becomes, how many undrafted free agents other than Leo Collins will make the team?
I can only think of two. I mean, outside of Leo Collins, I can only think of one.
And who might that be?
Lucky Whitehead. I've penciled him in as the last wide receiver.
And so, if it's not Lucky Whitehead, let's say it's Deontay Greenberry
or Sam
or Reggie Dunn somebody like that.
Reggie Dunn. I mean, not to jump ahead, but I liked what I saw from Reggie Dunn. I didn't know that really much about him other than I knew he was fast, and he showed me some things the other day.
He's been flashing.
Those wide receivers in general, like, there's just a huge group of guys who all look like they could easily handle the last wide receiver on the roster spot. I don't haven't seen any of them play special teams yet, which is really going to be their role, but as far as like being good enough to be a fifth wide receiver on this team, we got four of those guys. It looks like Farmer, Greenberry has shown things, Whitehead obviously, and then I like Dunn. I think he's shown some things, and there's a couple other guys too, all shown. And so that's the crazy thing again, is that it kind of goes back to, in the past we've been good about getting, especially undrafted free agent talent, and that hasn't really stopped. But what has stopped is that there's not enough room at the end for more than half of these guys. Like a lot of these guys, we're going to cut a lot of talented people this year, I think. And that's exciting. And that's now we're talking about trade bait and, all that stuff, instead of like worrying that we're going to even have 53 talented enough people to make up a professional football team's roster.
There have been many years in the recent past in which the Cowboys announce their cuts and the rest of the NFL takes one look at them and immediately goes to sleep.
We're good.
This year they're going to be hitting the phones because I think that there are probably 60 guys on this roster, or maybe more, who are legitimate NFL players. And so, this is yet one other little piece here in the larger global talent acquisition puzzle that happens, right? You flip your guys who aren't going to make the roster for sixth and seventh rounders, and suddenly, next draft or two, you got a few extra sixth or seventh rounders. And in addition to all the compensatory picks that are happening because they're being wise in free agency, mm-hmm. and suddenly you have a young, talented, deep roster. This is the way that smart organizations proceed, and it's been really interesting to see how so many of those little incremental changes they were making as they began to behave like the best franchises in the league behave, that weren't showing, they were not bearing fruit during the 8 and 8 years, and suddenly they began to bear fruit, and they all just seem to have kind of hit in the last, let's say, 12 to 16 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, and of course, very rewarding for us because, we were the ones who were in late 2011 were saying, we think Jason Garrett's going to do a really good job.
Yeah, and it sounded just like that, like a pimply-faced kids exactly. who didn't know what they're talking about. But we were convicted, and he's shown us to be right to a certain degree for sure. It's interesting, too, because there is another group, and I do agree that about, the idea of having some of this young talent and being able to flip those for picks. I would say, Cowboys fans, look out for guys who are on the last year of their rookie deals specifically. Those are always great trade bait guys because they're cheap. We're either not going to re-sign those guys because we got younger talent down the roster that is going to replace it, and it's easy to flip those guys for either picks or players, but usually just kind of low round picks. And we discuss some of these guys. I mean, people like Hannah may be a trade guy because he's on his last year, and if Swain shows out, those are kind of just examples of guys who may be a good trade bait. Are young guys still on their last year of their rookie deal, but don't look like they may get re-signed. So instead of why cutting them, let's get something for them. And we'll trade them for low round pick, mid round pick, and get something for them eventually.
Yeah. So imagine that they are. I think the example you used is a great example. So one could argue that they targeted Swain specifically for this possibility.
Yeah, I don't think that's unrealistic.
And the interesting thing about this is, he was a plus blocker in college. Nobody had any idea what kind of receiver he would be, or if he was even athletic enough to be a viable candidate as a receiving tight end. And because he just wasn't asked to do that. He didn't have a lot of targets.
Yeah.
But in the early going at camp, he's actually shown himself to be very fluid. He's a good athlete. He's got good hands. He may very well already be a better receiver than Hannah because he has a greater ability to cut at speed. And that's the one thing that Hannah, who's a deluxe athlete and is faster on the 40 than Mo Claiborne, for example, mm-hmm. simply can't do. He can't cut at speed. And so if Swaim can show himself to be a reasonably good blocker at all, and I think he's going to have to be good because losing Hannah as an asset in the run game would be a huge blow. But imagine that they're able to trade Hannah, who I think would be something that an asset that a lot of teams would really line up for. There'd be a lot
absolutely.
Of
yeah. I mean, he's got a lot of great tape. You know?
Absolutely. And so what they spent, I think, a sixth round pick on him.
Yeah.
Right. In 2011.
Yeah.
So imagine that they're able to trade him for a fifth. So you get three or four good years out of a guy. And then you trade him for a pick a round higher than what you spent on him. And in some ways, you recoup the sixth from next year that you spent for Swaim. And you may even get something around better. But even if you don't, say you trade him for a sixth, you recoup the pick that you spent for Swaim next year. And suddenly you have a brand new guy who's on a rookie contract who you got for three more years and you haven't lost a pick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty smart way to do business. Now, it's all gonna depend on whether Swaim can step up and be a reasonable facsimile of Hannah. But if he can, it's a pretty shrewd way of going about things.
And the reverse side of that is, you know, just to kind of go back to the running back spot, you know, if the Cowboys get into a spot where they're at the end of training camp, or maybe not even at the end, but they are at a spot where they're not feeling great about what they've got. That, you know, Randall has been given a chance to hang himself, given a rope to hang himself, and then he ends up hanging himself. Then they could easily do something like that, similar to another team that is deep at running back. That may is about, you know, mm-hmm. I'll use another, I think, likely scenario. If Thomas Rawls beats out Christine Michael in Seattle, and Seattle is just about to cut him, I guarantee you they're going to get on the phone with Michael and with the Cowboys and say, hey, what do you want for this guy? And, you know, mm-hmm. I think that would be a mutually beneficial deal for both teams.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what smart teams, they do. You know, that's why you draft your strength, is because if you're good at developing a particular position, especially a position that has a lot of need throughout the league, like tight end. I think tight end is not, you know, there's not a ton of great talent on a tight end all over the league, but offensive line even more so. Those make great trade bait players because, you know, the teams like the way they're trained. Obviously, Cowboys have a great history at this point of coaching offensive linemen and bringing them up. And I think, you know, that, you know, I think there was talk early on about trading Leary. I don't think that's going to happen at this point, just because I don't think he's going to lose his job. But, you know, Leary would be a good example of a guy that would be trade-worthy, extremely trade-worthy, because he started 16 games for the best offensive line in football. He's on the end of his rookie deal. You know, I mean, all those things, like, play into making him good trade bait. That's, you know, I think that's the thing that, like, when and not to get off into a whole trade thing, but that's the thing that I think people miss when they talk about trades a lot, is they don't talk about, like, the salary that the player currently has or you know, how old the player is. I mean, those are the things that these teams are looking at, is, you know, how much growth does this guy still have in him? What kind of pedigree does he have? You know, that sort of thing. Those are the things that make a player tradable in the NFL. It's not like the NBA where, you know, great players get traded a lot. It just doesn't happen as often. So,
yeah. So let me throw you. Let's throw one more example out there, then we'll move on. Which is an offensive line example that you've just brought us to. So they're going to probably have eight, maybe nine offensive linemen on the 53, and they can bring seven or eight. Or they'll dress seven or eight for game day. So let's imagine they're going to dress the starting five. They're going to have one guy who will be a swing tackle. And right now that guy is Weems. And then they'll probably have one guard center, or maybe one or two interior offensive linemen. So I think that the kid they brought in, who played center at Miami, Sean McDermott, mm-hmm. is in a training camp battle with Mackenzie Bernardo in the same way that Swaim and Hannah are in a battle, because this is Bernardo's last year in his contract. And so they would love to be able to do with McDermott what they're doing with Swaim and Hannah, I believe, because if McDermott can show himself to be anywhere near as good as Bernardo, and he's probably a better center or as good a center now, but the question then becomes, can he play guard? Then they can fill that backup game day interior offensive lineman role with a guy like McDermott instead of Bernardo, flip Bernardo for even for a seventh. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if they stay healthy, he's going to sit on the bench all year anyway.
Yeah.
And the great thing about that is, Maybe Collins doesn't make the game day roster. But if one of those guards goes down, Collins is the next guy up, and you still have McDermott as your game day swing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like McDermott's going to be playing much for his first year, unless there are multiple, God forbid, multiple injuries to the interior of the offensive line. And so, you know, if you look at it that way, then you think, well, Bernardo's probably not going to play much now anyway. In some ways, by having McDermott as your insurance only on game days, the chances of him actually having to play more than maybe the second half of a game where someone tweaks an ankle are pretty slim. And so you, in many ways, you give him a redshirt year this year, and then next year he can, you know, he can be a even more secure game day swing. And you flip a guy like Bernardo for an asset. So again, we don't need to, as you said, we don't need to belabor this point. And this is not necessarily the larger point of this podcast. But I think that, you know, one of the takeaways from looking at the roster in camp is that the front office has done such good work building this roster. It's deep and it's young, and there are going to be people that other teams whose rosters aren't as deep are going to be interested in, and this is going to do nothing but benefit the Cowboys this year and in future. So let me throw one other thing about the depth of the team out there, and then I'd like to move on to another topic. So one of the joys of camp, as I said earlier, is hanging out with all the other bloggers. You know, we sometimes have lunch before practice, sometimes we get together after practice, and we'll go somewhere that has internet access, and we'll all crank out our stories, and you know, there's sort of grunts, and you know, as we all work on our stories, and then usually and about an hour later we all fold our laptops up, and then you know, we BS about the team a little bit and share some observations. So Sunday before we went to practice, a couple of us met at a sort of local, you know, diner place that has a bar. And so we were sitting at the bar, had a drink, had an omelet, that kind of thing. And so I proposed a thought experiment to Rafael Vila, who, to my mind, is the dean of Cowboys bloggers. He was the one who was doing it first. And for many years has done it best. And I said to him, I'd like to propose a fill-in-the-blank question for you. And I said, this is the best Cowboys team since blank. And he, you know, it's the kind of thing you could just sort of throw out a number quickly, but to his credit, he started to, and then thought, he goes, and then he said, you know, that's a tough one. And he began to mull it over. I you know, he was saying, 2006, that team was, this one's better. And he kept comparing this team to the better teams at the end of the Parcells, beginning of the Phillips era. Mm-hmm. And finally, at the very end of that, he said, you know what? I think the answer is 1995.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
That was a damn good football team.
I know. I mean, so obviously this team is not as good as 95. So it's not that this team compares to 95, but that this team compares favorably to any team in terms of the depth of its roster. Now, not in terms of what it's going to do, because we don't know that yet.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of the depth of its roster at this point to any team since 1996, which is pretty impressive.
There haven't been a lot of football teams anywhere that have been as good as the 1995 Dallas Cowboys. But no, yeah,
I think a strong argument can be made that the only teams that were in football history that were better than the 1995 Dallas Cowboys were the 1992 and 93 Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, this is obviously subject to change. There's some very real questions that we've already talked about in terms of the running back position, et cetera. But I just think that, you know, when someone who's as thoughtful and well-schooled in this football team as a guy like Rafaela answers that, I think we all need to sort of sit up a little straighter in our chairs and take notice.
And he's not like some, you know, cheery-eyed optimist by nature. Any, just to give a little peek behind the curtain on him, is like, so like that, he didn't just kind of, you know, offhanded say that. I mean, I'm assuming, knowing him.
No. Yeah. It took several minutes of thought and weighing the possibilities before we arrived at that decision.
Wow. Well, that is definitely saying something. I mean,
I think so.
And like, listen, I mean, it's, you know, my mind wanders to 2007, and you know, I mean, and you know, I'm sure if we kind of extrapolated this all out and compared depth charts, I mean, you could look at it, but I tend to agree. I think it's somewhere in between, you know, that 1995 team and probably the 2006 or 2008 Cowboys. I mean, I think those were some pretty solid teams. So the question is, you know, where in between? That's a pretty wide gap still, but where in between do they lie in there? So
that's the story that history still has to write.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yep. That's the part that still needs to be played out in order for us to find out for sure. And listen, I did want to ask, kind of going back to your observations with practice, you know, have you noticed, Was there a tempo change that you noticed between, you know, the non-padded practices into the padded practices, or even maybe just from what you saw with the mini camp live stuff versus the first few practices of camp versus the padded practices?
That's a great question. And I think it actually leads me into another kind of topic that I would like to discuss. So my short answer is yes. It feels like...
You said it was slow. I mean, I know at first, but I mean, it was more that it was kind of like the news was slow and that there wasn't a ton of information. But I mean, you didn't mean that the practice was slow, right?
No, that's an important corrective. Yes, thank you for that. I think that that's absolutely right. I didn't mean that they are moving at a lethargic or zombie-ish pace.
They only got two drills done all day, basically.
That's right. Meanwhile, they're on the fence, sort of, you know, trying to scare the fans, murmuring brains. I don't understand what this is about. Anyway, yes, I think that. So let's go back a couple of years in which my early camp reports from, I think, 2013 or so labeled this as, you know, if we could, with tongue in cheek, talk about Wade Phillips camps as Camp Marshmallow. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to do was to rename Jason Garrett's camp Camp Tempo. And so there was a noticeable tempo change. It was very clear that what Garrett wanted to do, especially, you know, with the advent of the new CBA, was to maximize the little time the coaches had working their charges. And they were moving with great briskness and efficiency. And I think that that has continued to be the watchword, you know, tempo, throughout all of the Garrett camps that I've had the privilege of watching. But there's something about this one. They're even a step ahead of where they've been. Rather than the horn sounding and everyone running to the drill, it's like they finish their drills, they move to the next place, everything's set up, the horn sounds, and they begin.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting so many reps in, even when there's 90 guys, everybody's, you know, relatively healthy. They're getting a lot of reps in. And this actually leads me to my next point, which is, hopefully the connection will make sense in a second. My next point, my next observation is that in the first 4 days, at least, and this, again, like everything else we've talked about, is subject to change. The first 4 days, the day-to-day agenda has been identical. So what I mean by that is last year at camp, they began on a Thursday, just like they did this year. They had 2 days of non-contact walkthrough kind of practices. The third day was a Saturday, and that's when they first put on the pads. And in Saturday morning's walkthrough, just like they did last year, it was a special teams only practice. And then on Sunday, there was no walkthrough either year. And then Sunday was the second padded practice. And then Monday was an off day. So in terms of the larger scheme of this is what we're going to do day to day, it's been exactly the same. And in terms of what they're doing during each of the periods, it hasn't been exactly the same, but it's been very, very close. And so, in terms of the special teams period, they've been working the same thing every day. The first special teams period, in terms of the pat and go and the ball period and the kind of screen period that is part of their larger warm-up, it's been the same. And so there's a couple takeaways from this, one of which is that it's very clear that a lot of the kind of basic skills things that they want to do every day are not changing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is that they're not changing the schedule for, I think, a really sort of basic and clear reason, which is that this is the first time, 2014 to 2015, is the first time that the Cowboys have had the same head coach, offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, and special teams coordinator in back-to-back seasons since 2003-04.
Yes, that's amazing in itself. First of all, let's take a moment to look at that. But second of all, this was when you brought this up to me. The first thing that came to my mind is this is the first detail of why continuity is important. Because,
absolutely.
Because what it does, and this is just a small example, but it's an important example to point out is that. Now that they've done this before, there's a whole group of guys that are on this team that did this exact same program last year, so they know what's going to happen. They know what to expect, and that's good for them, and it's also good for these young guys because they don't have to go run to a coach to kind of get an idea of what's happening next. And, you know, most of them, probably the kids especially, are probably a little bit scared to go run to the coach and ask them, you know, hey, what's happening next? And they'd much rather go to a vet and talk to them, and the vet can explain to them, oh, yeah, this is how we do this. This is how he. And the vet can speak with authority at this point because having done that previously. And I'm sure that this is just the first of many, many things in this season where we're going to see the benefit of experience in the system, experience with these coaches, playing out and optimizing the ability for the team to focus on getting better, because they're not having to waste time to learn a new drill. They're not having to waste time to find out, you know, none of the rushmen that have been here last year are having to waste time trying to figure out the way Marinelli likes to do this or that. You know, like they know how he's expecting of them. The team knows what Garrett is expecting of them. You know, the offense knows how they want this play and that play run. How they want this drill and that drill run. And let's speak just specifically for drills and practice and that sort of thing. What it does is it just allows them to optimize practice time into strictly improving as opposed to having to waste, you know, even every little bit counts, having to waste even a minute or 2 minutes trying to explain a new drill or explain the nuances of a drill to young guys, is that now they know what they're going into, and it allows them to do exactly what you explained, where they're sprinting to where they need to be. Everything's set up. There's no explanation. They just get right into it. As soon as that horn blows, they're into the drill already. And I think that when you stack them up, you know, I hate to be parroting Garrett, but not really. You know, that when you stack them up day to day, the advantage gets more and more. You know, the advantage that you get that much more out of a week of practices than you would last year's week of practices, you know? And so I think those are all things that the hidden yardage of continuity, if you will, you know, that happens when you know what you're doing and you're doing what you're doing with confidence, then you can focus on the nuance of what you're doing as opposed to if you're doing it in a manner that's satisfactory to the coaches.
Yeah, you make several really important points there. And so allow me an illustration, and I'd like to reinforce one of the points.
Please.
So let's think about Rich Bisaccia, who got here in 2013. Right, so this is the third year running with Bisaccia. The other two guys, of course, got here last year, although Marinelli was a defensive line coach in 13. So the defensive linemen who have been here for those years, if there are any.
I was going to say.
I'm wondering if anybody is actually – Tyrone Crawford basically is the only one, I think. Uh-huh. But let's stick with Bisaccia. So there are two guys who are core special teamers for him, and maybe even a third if you want to include this guy, who were – special teams core guys in 13 and then have been in 14 and 15 as well. And that's Kyle Wilbur and Jeff Heath. Mm-hmm. And then we can also actually include Danny McCray in that. He left to go away for a year and then came back. But he's tutored under Bisaccia before. So these guys all understand the way that Bisaccia wants to work. He understands what the priorities are in terms of the way he wants to approach special teams. All the kind of large global stuff that tends to be you know, the early considerations, in some ways the equivalent of your lower division classes in your major if you're a bio major, right? Mm-hmm. You can't take classes on, you know, the mitochondria until you understand how the whole cell works or something like that, right? You can't, you know, do a sort of senior seminar in mitochondrial DNA until you understand how the basics of the cell, right?
You got to crawl before you walk, basically.
Thank you. Exactly. And so the thing about that is they know all about how to crawl. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important every year, as Jason Garrett intoned to the press early on in his early press conferences, that they start at what he called square one. And yeah, I think that's really good. So if you imagine you're Heath or Wilbur, and here you are at square one, and you're working with Bisaccia, and the first day he breaks down the kickoff coverage into its discrete units. It's really good to revisit that stuff up after a little bit of time away. At the same time, it comes back really quickly because it's not only in your head, but this is the key. It's in your muscle memory because you've been doing it for 2 years.
That's right.
So then once he begins to impart the more advanced lessons, you know, which have to do with the specifics of placement and spacing and working together and communication, and then even more specifically, hand technique. How do you get your hands on a guy? How do you screen him off? They can spend all their time really focusing on that stuff, and ultimately, that's where execution happens. And this is obviously with special teams, it's a much more difficult thing because it's so chaotic. But even if we think about offensive and defensive line or receivers, you know, in terms of hand fighting at the line, mm-hmm. when you've done this for 2 or 3 years running with a coach, you immediately understand what the kind of global, you know, priorities are, and you can get down to the nuances of technique. And, you know, when you go to training camp, one of the things you see and hear, and this is particularly true in the middle of the week when it's much more quiet, is how important these minute little adjustments are. You know, like Leon Lett and Rod Marinelli will tell their defensive linemen, you don't want to put your hand here, you want to put it here. And they move it maybe an inch or two.
Yes.
And so the idea here is when you put it here, then you can control his shoulder, then you have him. But if you put it here, you've got it only on his chest, and he can push back against you. And so if you've already learned that lesson, you already know the kind of essence of it and why its nuanced details matter, then you can spend your entire training camp putting that specific hand placement into your muscle memory so that the hand fires up and immediately goes to that secret spot where you can turn your opponent.
I think that's really cool because that also all feeds into kind of what we've talked about in the offseason last year and at many different points, is that one of the brilliant parts of Garrett's system, but on both sides of the ball, really, is that they do a great job of simplifying things so that the players can, this is basically just exactly what you were describing, they simplify things to the point where repetition gets you down to muscle memory, and then what they're coaching you during the week and during these training camp practices eventually is on nuance. It's not on major shifts, and it's about, no, hey, you know, and I'll give you a great example. Weems, when I came in there Saturday, I was watching Weems specifically because I'm interested in the guy. I think he could be a really great swing tackle, and I'm interested because I didn't get a lot of chance to see him last year, and it was really great to watch. You know, his seat was really low, and it was great. He had great strong power, had a good strong base. He was doing all the you know major arc things that you need to accomplish in order to have a proper. Pass protection set, right? But what you're teaching on him was, you know, matter of inches of where his hands go on the defender's chest. You know, mm-hmm. they're now debating, you know, hey, instead of upper chest near his neck, we need mid chest near his breastplate. You know, and it was like, and that's the nuance that's being taught in that those two reps is, hey, let me see you do that a little bit better. And when you're talking about those inches, you know, like once you're getting to those, it reminds me of that great speech from Any Given Sunday. When you're talking about those inches, and that's what it's down to, you know, that means that these guys can play fast, and when they get the proper perfect technique down, even though that you may have seen the same stunt four different times, you may have seen us run the outside zone against you eight different times already, if my execution of that is flawless, it doesn't matter how many times you see it, I'm going to knock you back every single time, and we're going to win, you know. And I think I love that element of the Cowboys scheme overall, is the idea of strip it down, you know, build it block by block. And we've seen that too. And you pointed that out to me in your reports that, you know, every single day it's like that, you know, they started out with the proverbial John Wooden-esque, here's a football. This is what it looks like, gentlemen. And then, you know, the very first day they're talking about run block. They're talking about the outside zone, and then they build from that. And it's great to see them talk about that, but then also to witness them, building blocks, showing the building blocks to us. Okay, this is the outside zone. Okay, from the outside zone, we'll learn the inside zone. And from there, we'll learn the pin and pull. We'll learn, you know, how to counter each one of these. But we got to start with square one, or you won't understand the rest of it, you know?
And here's the wonderful thing about what we were talking about earlier, which is that they don't need to teach anybody the basic lessons, who is going to have to then try to employ them in a meaningful way during the season. So,
yes.
You know, provided that, you know, the starting 26, quote unquote, remains relatively unchanged, or if it changes, it's not somebody from outside the organization who has not been a part of this pedagogical atmosphere for a year or two. What that means is these guys are all scholars for a year. So Byron Jones will play some, but he'll mostly spend the year learning.
Yes.
So next year, when these same lessons are taught again, he'll say, ah, I know these lessons. Because, of course, one of the great attributes that he brings to the team is that he's such a great student. He's like, I know these lessons. Now I'm spending camp number two as a cowboy doing the kind of nuanced hand placement, foot placement, keeping my weight above my heels, all the kind of stuff that we've just been talking about, of course, that of course applies specifically to his position. And this goes with anybody who's drafted this year. When you have a deep roster and you don't desperately need your most talented guys to start right away, you give them all a year to learn. And so by the time they are expected to step into a starting role, they know exactly what's asked. They know exactly what the basic techniques are. They've been schooled in them, and they're ready to really step up and do that. It's a pretty sweet kind of combination of pieces that fit together really beautifully.
Well, even flowing into that, even just to kind of support even more how this front office has worked so well in concert with the coaching staff, even to keep to that point, the guys that they bring in, whether they're free agents or, you know, in some cases with these rookies. They're guys who are not being asked to do something that they haven't really done before, you know. And I think that has been the problem with some of our drafting in the past, and some of the issues with the scouting department not working well with the coaching, is that I think sometimes the scouting department sees it one way, and the coaches want to try to fit a square peg into a hole, you know. And I think if you look at, and I've totally forgotten the name of the young undrafted rookie from Miami, the offensive lineman that's the center.
Sean McDermott
is a great example, and Lael Collins too. They bring in these guys, right? And you were just talking about how they have hopes that this guy could be a backup swing guard and center. And the reason that you can do that, the reason you could bring in an undrafted free agent to do that, is A, he comes from a major program, so the step up is not that drastic. B, I don't know whether the general populace knows this or not, but both LSU and Miami run zone blocking system. So mm-hmm. Both of those guys are very well versed in the type of blocks that they're going to be doing, and basically the overall philosophy of the scheme. So, you know, they're not even starting from ground zero. They at least know what, you know, the scheme philosophy is about, and kind of they probably even know the exact kind of blocks they need to do. So even they're kind of just working on nuance and technique work. And so I think that's it all feeds into trying to get as flat a learning curve as possible, having to have these guys not have to think a lot when they're playing, which, you know, really kind of is a stark contrast to what we saw with the Rob Ryan defensive system, where, you know, he was running all these complicated schemes and everyone's having to learn a whole bunch of different stuff and everyone looks confused. Now they've stripped it all away so you can play fast and work on the subtleties of your technique and allow your athleticism to be the factor that beats these guys, and not, you know, trying to fool an NFL offense, which is kind of foolhardy to a certain degree.
Yeah, exactly. So if we could, you know, just to come up with a random numerical way to kind of illustrate this. So let's say you have 100 reps. What Marinelli is doing is saying, we're going to do five things, and we're going to rep each of those five things 20 times. Whereas, you know, Rob Ryan was saying, we're going to have 25 things, which gives us only enough time to rep each thing four times. So let's hope you get it. And then we have to move on.
Yeah.
And so let me offer two more illustrations of what you're talking about. But this is an pro-personal level. So Darren McFadden.
Exactly. Yeah. That was,
you know, worked with Frank Pollock in Oakland in Frank Pollock's blocking system, and, you know, spent a year there. And I don't think they would have brought him in unless Pollock had put a good word in for him. So clearly, at least Pollock feels like, you know, that McFadden both obviously has the experience, but has the kind of talent and skill set to succeed in his own blocking system. And then the other one is Andrew Gatchkar, who was a special teams demon for Rich Bisaccia in San Diego before he came here. And so there's even a guy you bring in already has an affinity, even if, you know, go back to his old playbooks or whatever, but there's already kind of affinity. He already understands what's expected of him, and he can hit the ground running in the same way that, you know, a collegian who runs the same system might be able to.
He also played for Eberflus, who he considers to be like a father to him, from what I understand. College in Missouri, yeah. I think that kind of even further feeds into this idea that you get guys who are comfortable with what you're asking them to do, and then you work on it. I would like, real quick, before we move on, to comment about the McFadden thing, because there's been a lot of talk about this, and I think he has been unfairly put into a box where saying that he can't do this because of his numbers from last season. I've done a whole bunch of study on the zone blocking system and studied a lot of Alex Gibbs and reading a lot of offseason specifically about this, because it fascinates me, and as a system, I think it's just a really solid system, and it has a lot of very simple principles that are very easy to describe. But of all the positions that are directly involved in it, I think maybe Alex Gibbs would even agree with me that one of the toughest positions to learn is running back, because what they're asking you to do is go against all the instincts that you've used your entire football career as a running back, and not run to daylight. They're asking you to read the blocks and then make a pre-designated cut based on what you see. And I think guys like McFadden and I think Murray struggled with it a little bit at first too. Which is shown by why he had a lot better success on a lot of power runs. Mm-hmm. And gap runs, is that, you know, these guys who are especially the elite level running backs, who, you know, the five-star recruits out of high school, you know, those guys, they have basically never had anyone tell them how to run the ball. You know, I mean, they're you know, elite level talents that have you know, broken state records and that sort of thing. So who would ever try to, you know, tell them how to do something, right? How to especially run the ball, which is, you know, arguably the most instinctual, you know, position in that kind of way that there is in football. What they've had to learn to fit into the system is kind of new and different for a lot of these guys, and I think there is a learning curve to a certain degree. I think that Matt McFadden has the physical traits to be a really good zone blocking runner, but I think, you know, it's whether or not it was easy for him to transition into what he had to do in Oakland, I think it was probably a tough learning curve for him. And I think, you know, I mean, it doesn't help that you don't have, you know, super talented offensive line either. But I think it's unfair to kind of write him off as a bad zone blocking system runner just because he wasn't able to completely change his running style in one season. So, end of tangent, off of soapbox.
But, okay, so that was nice. I liked you up on the soapbox. That was good. I think one more point needs to be made here.
Okay, and great.
This is we're taking a little bit away from this topic, but I was talking a second ago about how closely aligned the kind of basic practice schedule has been thus far from 2014 to 2015, and we talked about all the reasons why. I also think it's important to know that there have been a couple of key differences, and one of them that I think is really noteworthy is that the defense has been deploying almost exclusively in nickel. I mean, there's been a decent amount of base, but there's been a preponderance of nickel/dime defense. I wrote about it in several of my camp reports. One of the most interesting wrinkles is a dime defense in which either Byron Jones or Corey White has been the other linebacker next mm-hmm. to Sean Lee or next to Anthony Hitchens, depending on whether Lee's in that drill or not. Which allows them to have someone who can blitz, can cover, and then, if, you know, has the size if necessary to stop the run if it's third and eight. It's a really interesting wrinkle. But the larger takeaway here is that Rob Marinelli and his defensive coaches have been working on a lot of different interesting blitzes, a lot of zone dogs, a lot of really interesting interior blitzes, et cetera. And it makes me think, or at least I'll rephrase that. It made me ask, usually the first lessons are the most fundamental and foundational. So why is it that they're opening with this lesson? That seems an odd choice. You know, you'd think, let's open with bass, and then we'll start adding all the wrinkles. But they decided to open with this. And I think there are two reasons. The first of which, I think, is that the place where the Cowboys' offensive line was hurt most last year tended to be in those kind of interior blitzes. You know, they seemed to be most susceptible to, you know, delayed blitzes from linebackers or playing you know, kind of interesting line games, twists and stunts and that kind of stuff. So I think that part of it is an effort to get the offense used to seeing that stuff and dealing with it as early as possible. But the other thing I think is this, and it's going to be paired with something I'll share in a second. The other thing is this. I think that this Cowboys team is going to try to create more pressure. And that's a change from last year. Obviously, they weren't a huge sacking team last year, but it's a change in a couple of ways. One is that they're not going to just send four. I think they'll try to send four, and if they can create, you know, if they can get 50 sacks just sending four, they're going to do that. But I think the other thing is, I believe that they believe they have the team now where they can take more chances to get pressure. Whereas last year, I think they felt that they blitzed with the corners they had and also with the other defensive linemen they had. If they blitzed, there was a good chance if they blitzed five, those five guys were going to get picked up, and then one of their corners or, you know, one of their safeties was going to get exposed, and all it was going to do was result in a big play. It was a lot smarter to run the ball, to grind up clock, all the things we talked about last year, to win the time of possession and for the defense to play a nice zone and rally to the ball and keep things in front and try to create 8 to 10 play drives and hope that the offense would make a mistake. And it worked out pretty well. This year, I think their philosophy is changing in this key way. This year, instead of waiting for the offense to make a mistake, I think they're thinking to themselves, we're going to create mistakes. And so the other thing that I'm seeing at camp early on that leads me to believe this is that Jerome Henderson and the other defensive backfield coaches are schooling their cornerbacks, particularly in press man, mm-hmm. and a lot of press man principles. We're seeing a lot of work on hand placement and, you know, the sort of staying balanced and the nuances of foot placement for the first two or three steps, which are the most crucial when you're bumping a guy at the line. And they're also working a lot on running with a guy and then turning it to locate the ball, which you don't need to do to the same degree if you're playing off and if you're playing zone. So I get the sense that this year they're going to line up and say, we're going to get our big cornerbacks in the line. We're going to try to jam your receivers, and we're going to send a bunch of dudes. And Greg Hardy's going to be all over the field. And he's going to be a terror. And we're going to put pressure on your quarterback, and we're going to try to get him to make mistakes. And so this seems to be a team that more and more believes it's capable of getting a lead, and by extension, is building itself and trying to create a kind of philosophy so that they can play with a lead. You know, get ahead, pass. I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of the kind of Bill Walsh philosophy on offense, pass early, run late. It's the kind of stuff we saw like in 2007, for example. And then run late, and also, you know, if you get it by a couple touchdowns, let's throw a bunch of exotic blitzes at him and put Greg Hardy all over the place, and, you know, let the defensive line play with their hair on fire and see what happens.
Well, and I think this is funny because it kind of reminds me of, and even though I've kind of, you know, I've extinguished the flame on the on my desire and hope to see the unicorn that is the auto linebacker, I think this makes sense as to why we were hearing rumblings about them thinking about doing this sort of thing. Because honestly, I mean, even if they don't do it, and it doesn't, I mean, we haven't seen anything that's indicated that they are. I mean, this kind of defensive back linebacker hybrid position is an interesting thing, but it's not an auto linebacker or what they described to us as an auto linebacker. But I think it does explain why they were interested in kind of learning about that positioning now that we know that, oh, maybe they are planning on, instead of just kind of playing base and you know, a sort of Seattle defense mentality of just rushing four that we know are going to get there and then playing coverage on the back end. It would explain why maybe now they are a little bit more interested in blitz and that sort of thing. Because I agree. I mean, one of the things that really surprised me when I got there Saturday, and I'm pretty sure that you discussed it, was a little bit surprising too for you, is that they were working on blitzes day one of padded practice. Which to me, you're right, reads like it's a staple in the defense. I mean, which I wouldn't say necessarily was the case last year. I mean they blitzed because they had to, because you know they weren't getting there with four. But to see them kind of working on blitzes early on was a little bit surprising for me. Because you know I would think that just knowing the philosophy as it was, I mean, stunts, yeah, I mean, games, absolutely, but you know, DT, TE, twist, sure, why not? But blitzes, I mean, they were not fans of doing that a lot last season. Maybe the idea is that that now that they feel like they've got maybe a little bit better coverage on the back end, they feel a little bit more comfortable doing that.
I think so, and I think that, you know, when you're a confident team like this, I think you can develop a philosophy where you say, if we get down by seven because we give up a big play, it's okay, we got it, because we're going to get one back. Mm-hmm. You know, so obviously this is all subject to change, as everything in this early, early, deeply speculative conversation.
Yeah, we're just speculating here very much, yes.
Right, right, we're spitballing. But watching them and then talking to a couple of other people about this, I keep being reminded of the 2009 Saints. Now, the 2009 Saints, you may remember, you know, had Drew Brees at his peak and Sean Payton with his variable offense, a bunch of running backs catching passes out of the backfield, a stable of very talented receivers, etc. But the thing that and they scored a lot of points and ultimately ended up winning the Super Bowl by beating Peyton Manning and the Colts. But the thing that really marks that season. Obviously, they start off like, you know, 12-0 or something like that until the Cowboys went into the Superdome and beat them. But the thing that marks their season is how many turnovers they got.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those kind of self-fulfilling, you know, feeding frenzy kind of circles, a virtuous circle, if you will. You get a lead, you can put pressure on people, you can create turnovers, you can extend your lead. But there was a game in 2009 where the Saints – where I think they went to Miami. I think it was a fairly hot day in Miami, and the Dolphins played out of their minds, and the Dolphins got up on them early, and it looked like the Saints were going to go down to their first defeat of the season. And it was something like 23-7, or I mean, it was a pretty significantly 23-0. And the Saints got a couple of turnovers and roared back and ended up winning something like 42-26 or something. I mean, they ended up winning by a very comfortable margin. But the thing that allowed them to score in these bunches that year was the fact that they were getting all these turnovers, and they were getting turnovers because they had leads. They were getting turnovers because people felt like they had to take a chance to keep up with them. You know, I mean, like if you're looking at the Cowboys, and you're thinking, if we play vanilla, we play safe, this team's gonna kill us. Mm-hmm. The only chance we have is to take some chances and try to we have to take chances and try to make big plays. Well. If the other team feels that, and you're saying, fine, we're going to blitz you, and you might get a couple, but we're going to get a couple too, you know, then I think that you also increase your chances of scoring in bunches. And again, it's very early, but the early indications, the tea leaves as I'm reading them, are that the Cowboys coaching staff sees that this might be a very real possibility. And you know, obviously, as Cowboy fans, how can we be anything other than profoundly excited about that?
Well, I think that's as good a place as any for us to go ahead and wrap it up, Brab. It's great to talk about real football with actual pads and everything after such a long time away. So when is our next training camp chat scheduled?
Well, I think we're going to do it again in the middle of next week. Mm-hmm. So there are 3 days, and then they're going to practice Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then be off Friday this week. And then they'll practice over the course of the weekend. And then
the blue-white schedule scrimmage. The
blue-white scrimmage will be scheduled. That'll be interesting. And then they'll practice for Tuesday, and they have like a morning walkthrough kind of thing on Tuesday. And then they'll take a break and take like the 3 days off during which they'll travel down to San Diego and play the Chargers, the first preseason game.
Oh, my God, we have a preseason game.
Yeah, so crazy. So we'll talk again on the cusp of that. So we'll have two more little blocks of of training camp practices to talk about, and then we can also sort of speculate about what's going to happen in that preseason game. So I think by then we'll have a pretty good early handle on the 2015 edition of our beloved Cowboys.
I agree. So guys, make sure that you're checking Blogging the Boys for updates on the podcast and obviously on the Cowboys themselves all throughout training camp, through the preseason. You know, guys, we're getting real football. There's no reason not to be on Blogging the Boys and in the chat room and all the boards and discussing it with everybody. So make sure you hit Blogging the Boys and check out their Facebook page, like we said, Blogging the Boys, and their Twitter, at Blogging the Boys. And until next time, guys, happy trails.
Happy trails, y'all.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?